Well, I think it's just about time to get started. So thanks for joining us tonight. We're also joined by, thanks to Jason Lefkowitz, the YU Torah. So we'll be up on YU Torah as well. So any comments you make may be heard around the world. Good to be with everybody. And I was inspired to have this course. Of course, we can always talk about the sages and about the tales of the Talmudic sages and analyzing the Talmudic sages. But this Rabbi Binny Lau, Binyamin Lau, he's the nephew of Chief Rabbi Lau. He came out with two books. This is the volume that deals with the earlier period, which we're dealing with, the Hillel period. And we'll be, you know, I use that as a jumping board for other research about Hillel, and I'll be sharing that with you tonight. So you're welcome to read up on that. It's a book that's available, and I think Elaine Fox has an extra copy. I think Yoel has an extra copy. Welcome to read up on it. But we're going to go hopefully beyond that particular work as well. So I'm going to give out these sheets, and we'll get started.
I think Elie Wiesel has a book about the different sages. Have you ever seen
that? There's a book on the forefathers. Yeah, not familiar. Interesting. Yeah, sometimes it has interesting things to say. Okay. So what struck me about Hillel is that almost exclusively the stories about him seem to tell one salient feature about him, and that is that he's Hillel the Gentle. This expression, Hillel the Gentle, is my own expression, but the notion that he was gentle, even in English translations, I think we can squeeze you in. Excuse me for not getting up. I'm attached to this mic here. Although Wolf Levine, we just introduced ourselves before. That's why I'm in it. So the idea that Hillel is this grand rabbi, one of the great rabbis of all time, right? You mentioned the top two rabbis would be what? Hillel and? Oh, well. that's because at Baron Hirsch, they had a boy named Shammai who ran around for many years. But he's a good friend of mine. But who else? Hillel, Rabbi Akiva, right? There, Hillel and Rabbi Akiva, those are sort of our two prototypes. This great figure, one of the salient features about him is that he's gentle. Now, why does that strike you perhaps as unusual? A great, great rabbi, but his main feature was that he was gentle.
You mean in his interviews?
Yeah, that's given to a rabbi.
Right. How are you? There's plenty of extra chairs all around. Just come on, bring them in. Right, you expect them to talk about his great learning, the great sage. You expect them to talk about anything, you know, the bears, Larissa, Ben Bear. You expect them to talk about his sagacity, his learning. What else is strange about emphasizing the gentility or the gentle nature of Hillel? Why would that be surprising for one of the great rabbis of all time that would be one of his salient features? Yes. Why else?
Maybe it was compared to Shammai.
Ah, okay.
He was gentle and
good.
Or more liberal, I guess you might say.
Okay, so maybe it's not so much that we're so interested in the fact that he was so modest or gentle, but rather it's just the contrast. The other person who happened to live at that time, the Shammai character, who was not so gentle. So maybe it's by contrast. Good. What else?
Maybe he should just hold himself above everyone else.
Right. You would think that the rabbi, to some degree, has no choice but to be an iconoclast of some sort, whether intellectual iconoclast or just economically, as we'll see with Rabbi Gamliel. He's not aware of people who, just the plebeians, the common man. So you would expect that. But not Hillel. Again, for those who just came in, the expression Hillel the Gentle is my own, but we'll see this notion that he was very gentle. It's a salient feature in most of the few stories that we have about him. It's a very salient feature. So let's take a look at the first one assertion that indeed he is a modest man, just simply an assertion. Who would like to read that for us? Talmud and Sanhedrin, 11a. Esther, go ahead. That'd be great.
Our rabbis taught, since the death of Elias' prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, the Holy Spirit of prophetic inspiration departed from Israel.
So that's a generally assumed preposition, that the last three of the twelve minor prophets, the last three, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, were the last prophets in the formal sense. Go ahead.
Yet they were still able to avail themselves of the Bat Kol.
An echo from heaven often ascended from heaven even after prophecy ceased. Go on.
Once when the rabbis were met in the upper chamber of Guriah's house at Jericho, Bat Kol was heard from heaven saying, "There is one amongst you who is worthy that the Shekinah should rest on him as it did on Moses. But this generation does not merit it. The sages set their eyes on Hillel the elder."
Hillel Hazaken. So he's usually known as Hillel Hazaken, the elder. Elder maybe meaning sage. Zaken in Hebrew means zakana chachma, one who acquired wisdom. Whether he was a nasi, a prince, I saw some people questioned it. Generally, it's assumed that when you have a pair, the zugot, the famous pairs like Hillel and Shammai, or their teachers, Shmaya and Avtalion, that the first one was the Nasi, was the prince of Israel, and the second was the head of the court, the Av Beit Din. So generally, it's assumed in the Talmud that he was also a Nasi, a prince, like Rabbi Judah the prince. However, the usual appellation is Hazaken, the elder, the wise man. If indeed he was a Nasi, his gentleness is more surprising. If he's a prince, if he's an elder, it's a little more easy to understand. Continue.
And when he died, they lamented and said, "Alas, the pious man, the humble man, slightly Ezra, is no more."
Okay. So notice when they describe him, they give three appellations. Number one, pious. Number two, humble, Anav. And number three, disciple of Ezra. Why would you call Hillel a disciple of Ezra? What was known about Ezra? What's the main idea of Ezra? He began to bring more people back to Israel. Again, the temple was destroyed. 70 years later, some people came back. Things didn't get underway too well. When Ezra and Nehemiah, they reestablished what we call the Second Commonwealth, the Bayit Sheni, the Second Temple period, and he brought the Jews back to Torah. He stopped some of the violations of the Torah, and he reestablishes Judaism. So by comparing him to Ezra, we're saying that it's the same thing. That Hillel is basically a person who reestablishes Judaism. He gets it going. Some people want to take an approach that Hillel is the one who sort of has the beginnings of this whole Talmudic process. As a believing Jew, that's not a traditional view. We usually say that the Talmudic process goes way, way back to Sinai. But the idea that he developed, he helped elaborate on the Talmudic process and the Midrashic process, as we'll see later, this is something we can say, that the yeshivot flourished, starting with his teachers and continuing with Hillel. Certainly the house of Hillel, the house of Shammai, Beit Hillel, Beit Shammai, that certainly many of the debates that began in Israel began in his footsteps. So, in that sense, like Ezra, pious man, we'll see later, and also the idea of a humble man. So, unless there are any questions, we'll go on to the question of what do they mean that he's humble? Any questions? Yes?
Well, your first title here says, "Oh, what a modest one." But other than the reference that he's humble, mm-hmm. there's really nothing related to him being modest in this first paragraph.
Well, humble, modest, I don't know. I'm taking that as a synonym.
Okay. But what I'm saying is, they use three synonyms to describe
mm-hmm. Right.
But the whole paragraph is describing a bigger situation.
Yes, what is the main point of the paragraph?
It's not that he was humble or modest.
Right, what's the main point?
It's that
worthy of the Shekhinah, like? Well, at the end, they throw in Ezra, who was also like Moses, by the way, because he read the Torah to them again. He changed the script. Some say he changed the script. They used to use a different script, the ancient script. They changed it to a different script. He used Ezra the scribe, HaSofer.
Yes. The prophets aren't necessarily, prophets are there for a message. They're not necessarily the ones who are closest to God. It may be a good person like Hillel. It was pious, humble, and disciple of Ezra.
Yeah.
Was, in fact, the one who was closest to God.
You're saying Moses, what's Moses? Moses is very close to God. So they're saying that he's really very close to God. But the Rambam points out that a person could do all the work on themselves to be worthy of being like Moses, but then it doesn't mean that we become a prophet like Moses, because that depends on your luck and your generation and the merit of the generation and the era that you live in, etc., etc. But our job is to do the work to become a prophet. That's what the Rambam says in the Mor Nevuchim, in the Guides of the Perplexed. So similarly, Hillel had done all the work, and he had all the characteristics, but he couldn't make it. So what's the connection? Ben's point is excellent. We're saying that he's the humble one. In the end, they say he's humble, but that wasn't the point. In the beginning, we were really saying that he deserves to have the divine presence on him, like Moses. What's the connection between the divine presence and being humble?
Moses.
All right. So it becomes clear that what they're saying is that we start off by saying that he's just like Moses. He has the divine presence. He should have the divine presence like Moses. So then we say, "Ay, what a humble man, just like Moses." So all of a sudden, it's less surprising. We thought maybe a leader should be powerful. We're going to talk later on in our series about Rabban Gamliel, and the title of our discussion that week is Rabban Gamliel, the tyrant? Question mark, right? He sounds like a tyrant. That's what you expect from a chief rabbi, a nasi, a prince, a leader of Israel, a person taking the role of the scepter of leadership when there is no leadership. At the time of Hillel, it's around the year zero. He lived a little bit before the Common Era and into the Common Era. And Herod is in charge, at least during a part of his time. Herod is going around, he killed his wife, he killed the rabbis, right? And then to make up for it later, he builds the Kotel and the temple compound, and it's magnificent. So there's all this magnificence and grandeur and power. But he's not really, he's quasi-Jewish, he's not really a Jewish leader, he's really helping us become a Roman patronage. We're not really a Jewish state anymore. So he's the Jewish leader within this very secular state. He's the kind of a Jewish leader. And he's modest. He's reestablishing Judaism, putting it on a footing that will take us past the destruction of the temple into today's, all the way to today. And he had that humility. All right, let's go on. What do we mean that he's humble? What do we mean that he's humble? There's a lot of ways of looking at humility, expressions of humility. So here's, one of about five stories that appear. I'm sorry, we'll get to that in the next page. That's the next page. Right now, we'll talk about a different way in which he's humble. Let's take a look. Let's see this.
Rav Abba studied in the name of Shmuel. For 3 years, there was a dispute between Shammai and Beit Hillel. The former asserting, the halacha is in agreement with our views, and the latter contending, the halacha is in agreement with our views. Then a Bat Kol, a voice from heaven, issued announcing, the utterances of both are the words of the living God, but the halacha is in agreement with the ruling of Beit Hillel. Since, however, both are the words of the living God, what was it that entitled Beit Hillel to have the halacha fixed in agreement with their ruling?
You see, the voice from heaven says that on the one hand, they're both, what the school of Shammai and the school of Hillel, are the words of the living God. But on the other hand, the voice from heaven says the halacha follows Beit Hillel, the house of Hillel. So why? If they're both the words of God, why should we follow Hillel? Go ahead.
Because they were kindly and modest. They studied their own rulings and those of Beit Shammai, and were even so humble as to mention the actions a Beit Shammai before theirs.
And then they give an example, classic Mishnah, you always quote Beit Shammai first, then you quote Beis Hillel. Now this is not Hillel and Shammai, it's the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai. I'm extrapolating that that it comes from their teacher, Hillel. You can argue, but generally, let's assume that this was true of Hillel as well, that he taught his words, that of his nemesis, of his antagonist, Shammai first, and then his own ideas. Go ahead.
This teaches you that him who humbles himself, the Holy One, blessed be he, rises up, and him who exalts himself.
So it's not my translation, I guess. But anyway, go ahead.
Yes. From him who seeks greatness, greatness flees. But him who flees from greatness, greatness follows. He who forces time is forced back by time, but he who yields to time finds time standing at his side.
Could be it's not really time, is maybe not your translation, but if he who tries to seize the moment will seize him. He who lets things happen, then things will happen for him, something like that. But in any event, although this is about the later period, the students of Hillel after Hillel's death, one can certainly suggest that Hillel set a tone that we accept the rulings of others, and that we listen to them. We study the other person's point of view. Many people point out if you're listening carefully to the other point of view, then you win, because at least when we say, okay, this person has considered not only his own view but the view of his antagonist as well, and therefore perhaps he's more correct. This passage seems to be echoed by the next passage. Wolf, you want to read the next two passages for us? The next passage is from the Midrash.
And so Hillel said, my raising is my falling, and my falling is my raising. What is the reason? He who lifts up to sit and lowers to be seen.
Hamagbi lashavet, hamashpili lirot. It's a very stretched reading of the text, but basically it interprets that he lifts up. He lifts up people, but then he says, sit down. And then he lowers those who are to be seen. In order to be seen, you have to be up. So he lowers those who are high. There are other verses that they could have quoted that say the same thing. But this notion, this citation here in the Eruvin 13b in the second passage is echoed by Hillel himself. Notice, although passage 2 is about the house of Hillel, he himself is quoted in the Midrash as saying something very similar, that his raising is his falling. Just like they say here, he who raises himself up, God will lower him down, he'll humble him. So too, that was a saying that he used to say, my raising is my fall. If I raise myself up to be haughty, that's my downfall. If I'm falling, then that my humility will be, will enable me to rise up. So this is part of his ethic. Now, in Pirkei Avot, there are two sections where he's quoted. This is one of the sections that I thought was more relevant to this theme of humility and gentleness. Wolf, want to just give us that whole section from Pirkei Avot, please. Oh yes. Of them, that means. There were pairs of people who were generally assumed to be the Nasi, the leader, and the head of the court, and that was Shemaiah and Avtalion. We'll come back to them later. Shemaiah and Avtalion, they transmitted to Hillel and Shammai. There is an interesting question. There was somebody, instead of Shammai, there used to be a fellow named Menachem. Who would know, right? And there are all kinds of theories. Was he an Essene? Was he a heretic? Was he went off to business? Or, a character who joined Herod, somebody who became a good friend of Herod, all kinds of theories who this other fellow was, but eventually Shammai comes in and takes over. Let's continue.
Hillel would say, be of the disciples of Aaron, a lover of peace, a pursuer of peace, one who loves the creatures and draws them close to Torah.
So does this fit with this image of Hillel the gentle? Hillel the modest one?
Yeah.
I would think so. Go ahead.
He would also say, one who advances his name destroys his name.
Familiar? Similar to the idea of my lifting is my falling. Go ahead.
One who does not increase diminishes.
Generally we say one who doesn't increase his Torah study diminishes. And we'll see later, Hillel was very much known for his great devotion to Torah. Go ahead.
One who does not learn is deserving of death. That's a very strong statement.
You should always be learning. That's why you're all here, so you're in good shape. Okay, go ahead.
And one who makes personal use of the crown of Torah shall perish.
Ah, okay. So that tells us something, right? We talked before that you would think that someone who's lifted up to be on the great podium would feel like they had the crown of Torah. And he says, don't use the crown. Right? Don't use that crown. There's a story of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, a different prince later on, one of his descendants, who organized the Mishnah. And he appointed a student once who was very expert. He puts him up on the podium and he says, this student, he can answer all your questions. He sent this student to be the next rabbi for the community. The people ask him three questions. He's totally dumbfounded. He has no idea. He's silenced. He has no idea what to say. Comes back to the rabbi. The rabbi says, you did me dirty. I sent you up there to be the great rabbi. You couldn't. Don't you know the answers to those questions? He says, of course I know the answers to those questions. But they put me on this big box, and I was standing up in front of all these people, and I totally lost myself. So he says, don't you make use of the crown? Don't try to boost yourself up too much. Let's go ahead.
He would also say, if I am not for myself, who is for me? And if I am only for myself, what am I? And if not now, when?
So many people would say that this is his most famous saying. We'll see another one as well later on. Does this fit with what we're talking about? With the modesty?
No.
Not really. Right? Not really. Right? This seems to be a limitation on the concept of modesty. That still, if I'm not for myself, who is for me? There is some limitation on that. You do have to stand up for yourself. It's not the idea of being an absolute shmata. Yes.
I would argue that if that's all he has said, that first statement,
mm-hmm.
it makes sense. Mm-hmm. But the next statement mm-hmm. says, well, it sounds like he's being more practical. You have to look out for yourself, mm-hmm. but you've got to. Just can't look out.
Not only for yourself.
So there's
right. So that
qualification.
Right. That would be
in my mind back in time.
Good. That would be the second answer, or perhaps even a better one. That it's two halves of a coin. We have to look at both sides. I'm not for myself. Who is for me? That seems a bit haughty, but he balances that with the idea that if I'm not only for myself, what am I? So the need for the community. And this is the famous balance between community and individuality, which all communities struggle with, right? Communists emphasize the community. America is a big individualistic place, and everyone tries to find the balance. And Israel tends to be also very communally oriented. So it's a big question. But anyway, so it gives you a little flavor of some of the things he was famous for, and also this idea that he emphasizes being like Aaron, lover of peace. It seems to fit this, don't advance your name too much, seems to fit this image of Hillel the gentle. This now for the classic story to really flesh out what it means to be Hillel the gentle. We talked about being Hillel the gentle in the context of learning. Right? When you're learning, how are you gentle? How are you modest when you're learning? What do we say?
You listen to others,
you put their words first. Now, in a different context, what it really means to be modest, even as you are this great rabbi. All right, then?
Modesty in action. Our rabbis taught, a man should always be gentle like Hillel, and not impatient like Shimon.
Okay, now the word, this translation comes, I think, off the Sansino, off the internet. Gentle, it really says humble. Anvatanan. But Anvatanan sounds like it comes from Anav. I've heard some people say that no, it doesn't. In this context, it doesn't mean modest; it means gentle. So, do you see the relationship between gentle and modest? Right. Humble sometimes means like someone like of humble beginnings, humble origins. And there is an element of that. Many of you know the Talmudic story, which we'll get to later. That he couldn't afford to get into the yeshiva. So he actually comes from humble beginnings. That seems to be belied by the assertion later on that Hillel and all his descendants are actually descendants of David, of King David. So does he have lowly beginnings? Does he have great beginnings? But I guess someone who descends from David could also fall into poverty as well. But anyway, so the poverty may be an element of his humility. But anyway, you should always be gentle or perhaps modest like Hillel. Go ahead.
Well, they contrast that with the word impatient. So,
right. So, right. There, I believe the right. There, I think the expression is clear. I think as they say, ragzan, someone who gets angry. So, right. So it's almost like it should, if you want to just translate in the context, we should always be patient and not impatient. But the actual word that's used is not gentle, not patient. It's anvatan, anvatanan, or something like that, which at least comes from the root of modest. Interesting. Go ahead.
It once happened that two men made a wager with each other, saying, "He who goes and makes Hillel angry shall receive 400 zuz." Said one, "I will go and incense him."
So they made a bet to try to get him angry. Obviously, he was known as someone who you couldn't get angry. Go ahead.
That day was the Sabbath eve, and Hillel was washing his head. He went, passed by the door of his house, and called out, "Is Hillel there?"
Right. Those of us who prepare for Shabbos know that the most tense, crazy time of the week is when we're washing for Shabbos. That means it's the last minute. There isn't much time left. This is a great time if you really want to get somebody mad, right? Try calling me 10 minutes before Shabbos. Not a good idea. Go ahead. Very gentle, right? My son, right? Bani. That's the way you talk to someone. You're trying to be very gentle to. Go ahead.
"I have a question to ask," said he. "Ask my son the prophet." Thereupon he asked, "Why are the heads of the Babylonians round?" "My son, you have asked a great question," replied he, "because they have no skillful midwives."
Right.
"He departed, tarried a while, returned, and called out, 'Is Hillel there? Is Hillel there?' He rose and went out to him, saying, 'My son, what do you require?' 'I have a question to ask him,' said he. 'Ask my son,' he prompted. Thereupon he asked, 'Why are the eyes of the palm?'"
Don't ask me where that is, but someplace. Go ahead. Mm-hmm. Bleary. Go ahead.
"Ask all the questions you have."
So there were more. I didn't want to give a, didn't have enough space for all the questions. He goes on and on, the Africans, and these people have flat feet and this kind of feet. So he asks all kinds of silly questions about different nationalities and the squinty eyes and all kinds of things. There's a lot of sand, so the eyes are skin. Go on.
"Are you the Hillel who is called the Nasi of Israel?"
Okay, so this passage seems to go against this professor I read who said, "Oh no, he's not a Nasi," but the fact is we're talking about 2,000 years ago. We're talking about the Talmud is being written several hundred years after this man lived. So there is a certain murkiness, there's an element of ancient history that we're getting into. We just have a few stories. There aren't that many more stories than what I'm giving you tonight. There aren't that many other stories about Hillel. Here it's claiming that he was a Nasi, that he was a prince, that the princehood began before the temple was destroyed. Continue. Right, it could be. Yeah, probably not in this context, but it's possible. Go ahead.
"Yes," he replied. "If that is you," he retorted, "may there not be many like you."
Yeah, that's a blessing you're supposed to say when you see a wonderful scholar or a pious person. You should say, "Oh, there should be more people like you in Israel." It's a blessing. And he's giving them the curse part of it. Go ahead.
"Why, my son?"
Are you still not mad at him? Go ahead.
"Because I have lost 400 zuz through you," complained he. "Be careful of your moves," he answered. "Hillel is worth it that you should lose 400 zuz and get another 400 zuz through him. Yet Hillel shall not lose his temper." After a similar story with prospective converts, the convert said, "The modesty of Hillel brought us under the divine
vineyard." Right. You may be familiar with the other story. Again, we don't have time for every single story. One of these stories of trying to get Hillel mad were convert stories. Two of them. Several. The convert comes in. He says, "Teach me the whole Torah on one foot." He tells him, right, we'll see later, what you hate, don't do to your friend. And the rest is commentary. Go learn it. the fellow says, teach me the Torah. I only want to learn this part of the Torah. I don't want to learn the oral Torah, only the written Torah. I don't want to learn the Talmud. He says, fine. Well, and then later he shows him that you need both parts. And at the end of the story, the converts get together who are all converted by him and who were chased out by Shammai. And they say the modesty of Hillel brought us under the divine pinion, under v'tenutan, under v'tenuto, the same expression, the modesty. Now, you might have argued that this is not a story of modesty. What is it a story of?
Patience.
As a matter of fact, some people who, there's a theory that Hillel is Egyptian and therefore Greek. What does that mean? Generally, he's known as Hillel HaBavli, that he came from Bavel. And there's a passage in Pesachim, which we're not going to study, that says that he came from Babylonia. Someone to argue that Babylonia is just an expression for outside of Israel, and he really came from Alexandria, where they spoke Greek, like in the days of Philo, if you're familiar, the rabbi who didn't speak Hebrew. The rabbi spoke Greek. He wrote his commentary on the Torah in Greek. They were a very secular bunch over there. They had a very large community. Eventually, they were persecuted, and they all died. But for a while, it was a Greek, a Hellenistic type community. Some modern scholars want to argue that he came from a Greek background, and that what do you call someone who never gets mad? What's the Greek expression for the type of philosophy where you never get mad and you always remain calm and all that? What do you call it? It's an English expression for people who are very calm. Stoic. He's a Stoic. And he's also like Plato or something. People ask him questions. He's also very broad-minded. They ask him questions about Babylonian people's heads, Chinese people's eyes. He's African's feet. He knows everything. He's broad-minded. There's another story about him that he says he's going to do a great mitzvah. He says, "What mitzvah are you doing?" He's going to go to the bathhouse. He's going to clean his body. It's also from God, and we're made in the image of God. So he seems to have a very broad point of view, and he's very stoic. But interesting, is there really a contradiction between being patient and modest if you're a rabbi being interrupted and as you're preparing for Shabbos?
Not necessarily a contradiction, but they're not necessarily the same.
Right. But depending,
modesty doesn't make you patient, I wouldn't say.
Well, I guess arrogance probably makes you more impatient.
Right, I guess they could be unrelated, but here when they come together, he's the great rabbi, and instead of coming and asking some Torah question or some, they seem to be asking these foolish questions. So then it seems to come together. Being patient, given that he's a great rabbi, and being asked these foolish questions and being able to be patient in that context seems to indicate a certain modesty that he doesn't think that he's too great to be asked such a foolish question. You can picture Shammai was very insulted by the notion that you could learn the whole Torah on one foot. We know that rabbis spend the whole day, the whole life on Torah, so it's a very insulting kind of a thing. So you have to be very modest about your whole activity, your whole life. So it's interesting. Whether the people who are framing this story, they want to tell a story of modesty. Could be that the story itself belongs more in the realm of Stoicism and the idea of being very temperate and not losing your cool. The Greeks talk a lot about not getting angry, and the Rambam in the footsteps of the Greeks, very big on that, not getting angry. It's a very high value. Okay. Now a few questions about this story. How could he answer the fool so seriously? Doesn't it say in Proverbs, don't answer a fool according to his foolishness, right? As a foolish person, sometimes if someone's trying to get at the rabbi, they'll ask a really foolish kind of question. So sometimes you want to get in the dirt with them. I'll get you for that one. So the proverb says, don't answer a fool according to his foolishness. If it's foolishness, let it just be foolish. Give him a foolish answer. So that's an interesting question. How could he give such serious answers to such foolish questions? It's against a verse in Proverbs. Any thoughts?
brings love and dignity to the speaker by acknowledging him as someone worthy of a thoughtful response.
That could be. That's similar to what both the Maharsha, one commentator on the Talmud, and the Maharal said. They both tried to beef it up, to say that somehow he's trying to dignify their question. He thinks maybe there's something more deep behind what they're asking. Maybe he's really asking whether the Babylonians are too haughty or things like that. There's some, I forget the exact parables, but he's taking it as a parable. These questions are deeper questions, and they have some deeper meaning. Again, one modern writer, Israeli writer, so he thought that these were types of questions that a Greek scholar might get. Or you could say that he tried to dignify their questions by thinking that they must be asking something deeper. Anyway, an interesting question. It could be that he put the value of modesty over this value of the Proverbs. In other words, he was accused of being a fool for falling for their question, right? What a fool. He answered the question. I was just kidding. It was a rhetorical question. He put the value of modesty over this value of the book, verse in Proverbs. Okay. Then there's a question. How can he be modest and still lead? Right? If he's really a leader and the Jewish people are kind of falling apart, Herod killed one of his sons and he drowned them his father and brother, they went to the Romans and complained about the other one and the Jews lost their sovereignty. There's a lot of horrible things going on. He's supposed to be taking the reins and helping the Jews through their most difficult period right before the destruction of the temple. And he's so modest. How is it possible? How is it possible to lead? Or we have the Talmud in Kiddushin that even on the view, if a rabbi renounces his honor, it's renounced. If I want to be treated lightly, the rabbi doesn't have to be honored. If he can say, it's okay. You know, call me Joel. It's okay. He can renounce his honor. But if a nasi, a prince such as Hillel, renounces honor, his renunciation is invalid. A prince must act like a prince. So these are some of the questions. On the bottom of the page, you have an approach here. He says, this is a classic approach. It's based, one citation is from Chovat HaLevavot. That's the Rabbeinu Bachye Ibn Pekuda. That, you know, modesty means to know how great you are. He doesn't need their acclaim in order to feel important. His sense of dignity, and his modesty comes from knowing who he is. So he knows who he is. He's not bothered by that. On the other hand, there's an interesting story they tell Rabbi Akiva Eger. He once went with another fellow to shul, and let's say that shlishi is more important than shishi. Okay, let's say. So the other fellow got shishi, and he got shlishi. The Rabbi Akiva Eger, he got the bigger honor. So you say he almost fainted because he was so ashamed that he got a bigger honor than his friend. He thought his friend should get a bigger honor, so he was a very modest person. But one time he got mad at somebody, and he said, "How dare you speak to me that way? I am the honor of Torah." So on the one hand, the quality of modesty is common among rabbis. But on the other hand, there is this question of doesn't he have to maintain the honor of the Torah? Right? Well, what does it do to the honor of the Torah when people are treating him so lightly? So we have to figure out. What is this all about? Why are the rabbis, in these few memories they have of Hillel, they're emphasizing that he was extremely modest and humble, and he let people kind of walk all over him? What is it all about? We'll get to a theory about it a little bit later. Then another question: how does this attitude affect his policy? Meaning, who cares? So once upon a time there was a guy named Hillel, he's a great rabbi, and he happened to be very modest. Okay, very good. Okay, good. That's very nice, but. But in terms of history, in terms of what his actual contributions, is that his only contribution, that he was a model of modesty? What were some of the great things that he did? And if he did some great things, is there any relationship between the great things he did and the modesty that he had? That's our next question. Now, the fact is, there are only, So first we're going to see how it affected a certain policy he had, and then we're going to see two laws that he enacted. There are only two enactments that he made. We only have four debates between Shammai and Hillel. Some say five. The Shammai and Hillel themselves, we only have around record four or five things they debated. I'm not going to share that with you. And we only have two enactments, like, I hereby decree that from now on this is the law. We only have two enactments that he made, and that's it. For instance, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, we'll study next week, he has many more enactments. He's famous for his enactments. So we'll see the two on the bottom of the page, going to the next page. But first of all, a few things were affected by his modesty. Whose turn is it? Let's see. Larissa?
By his many students.
Okay, that's in the earlier sages had said, if you look in the beginning of Pirkei Avos, the Ethics of the Fathers, one of the three things that the first sages said was, Hamidu Talmidim Arbe, you should make a lot of students. That there should be many students. Go ahead. So this is called Avot Rabbi Natan. There's another version of Pirkei Avot. It's attributed to Rabbi Nathan, who was an editor of passages. And there are many versions of it. The Salman Schechter, the famous textual scholar of 100 years ago and more, he was at Oxford or Cambridge or something. And there in the library, he had different manuscripts. And in one of his versions, version B, the following text appears commenting on the earlier statement that you should raise many students. Go ahead. You don't teach everybody. You only teach the kosher ones. It's nothing to do with kosher and treif and barbecue contest. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do, kosher is an expression for a kosher Jew. Kosher Jew has nothing to do with whether you keep kosher. It means whether you as a whole, you're a kosher person, like, you know, a good person. In all ways, including, you know, Jewish law, etc. But it's a broad expression. So if someone's kosher in every way, you teach them. And also, what else?
Why does it say we don't teach only?
No, it's an expression. In Hebrew, you say, Ein lemeidim ela, you know, you only teach. So in English, they put in, right, we don't teach, only. Yeah, you have to read it like, you know, in Yiddish. We don't teach, only if they like this. Go ahead.
The children of fathers and the children of children of fathers.
What do they mean? What does he mean? Everybody has a father. What does he mean? Perpetuate many generations of learning, or somebody who's really a father, you know what I mean? Like, somebody worthy of, you have to come from the right stock, you know? So, Shammai, some people accuse the Sadducees also of being elitists. Some people say that Shammai was the elitist, he was the rich class, and that's why they could be so strict about Jewish law, because, so you lost a few dollars on your vessel that you had to throw in the garbage or something like that. No big deal. Whereas Hillel is dealing with more of the plebeians. It's a theory, I don't know if it's true or not, but this may support that idea. Go ahead.
The house of Hillel said, to every man.
So whom do you teach? To every man. Go ahead.
What is this like? Like a chicken who sits on many eggs.
Actually, it really should translate, like a woman who's raising eggs and chickens, so she puts many eggs under the chicken. She's not sure which one are gonna hatch. So she puts a whole bunch of eggs under the chicken. Go ahead.
From many she produces some. From some she does not produce any.
Right. If you don't put enough eggs under there, you don't get anything. If you only put one, you put all your eggs in one, all your baskets in one egg, you get another garnish. But if you put a lot of eggs in there, you come out with something. So you have many students, so at least you get some students. So again, we ask this question: it's true. This is the house of Shammai and the house of Hillel, but maybe we can project that this reflects the attitude of Shammai and the attitude of Hillel. How does the attitude of Hillel affect policy in the yeshiva?
guess when you're less modest, you're more likely to lead us.
So it has that effect. And that relates to his birth story, the only story we have of his background, aside from the assertion that he's from the house of David, which doesn't tell us much about his actual upbringing. It just means in his family tree somewhere there's a David in there. But this is the famous story of that when a person comes to the heavenly court, let me just see what time it is. And when a person comes to the heavenly court, they'll say, "Why didn't you study Torah?" He says, "I was too poor to study Torah." He says, "What do you mean? Hillel, right? He climbed up and he sat on the window to hear the words of the living God from the mouth of Shemaiah and Avtalion. That day was the eve of Shabbos." They have a very detailed story. It was a winter solstice. It was December 21st. And the snow fell down upon him from heaven. He's trying to listen to the Torah from the window and he's getting snowed on. And then they said, "Hey, wait a second. It's very dark in here. What's going on? There's no..." They looked up and they found him covered with 3 cubits of snow. That's about 4.5 feet. They removed him, bathed him, and anointed him, even on Shabbos. And they placed him opposite the fire and they said, "This man deserves the Shabbos be profaned on his behalf." So we see that he had humble beginnings and why? So we can project, again, just a projection and just a suggestion. But why did he believe you should let everyone in the yeshiva? Right. He himself had experienced what it means to be stuck outside and ridiculously be snowed in. So he became a proponent of let the doors open, let all the students come in. Some people want to suggest there's also a socioeconomic question here. This relates to the modern day Haredi work crisis. You see, they say he used to work a little. He'd work a little bit, collect a few sticks, you know, for firewood. He'd sell them, and then he'd try to come in. So that didn't cut it. The tuition was greater than what he could earn in his half a day. So apparently, how did the other people get in? The wages. Okay, that could be. The economic suggestion is that they were working a whole day, and then they could get in at night. He was trying to do half a day, and that wasn't enough. So they were trying to encourage people, you know, get back to work, and he was taking a new track, which said, "There's a lot of Torah to learn. Some of us have to." You know, spend half a day studying. No one's suggesting you shouldn't work at all. Again, he's one of the great. This is a source that you should work and study, but perhaps he was one of the initiators of the idea of more time for study. So he is an exemplar not only of modesty but also of this tremendous devotion to study. We don't have to say any more. We get the concept. If it was snowing and the 3 feet of snow on his head, he's still trying to hold on and listen to the lecture. So we get it. He's a towering scholar, or at least a workhorse of a student. Okay. Then we ask, how does modesty affect his policies in Jewish law? We have two institutions he made. One is very famous, other less so. The first called Prusbul. Prusbul is all kinds of theories as to what language it comes from, what it means. But the main thing is we have to know the following. That in the Torah it says that when the seventh year comes, then at the end of the seventh year, we interpret to mean the Rosh Hashanah after the sabbatical year, your debt is canceled. So if you owe $1,000 to somebody, when the end of the seventh year comes, it's canceled. So the Torah itself says, hey, wait a second. Somebody might say to himself, well, it's already the sixth year. I lend him the money now. His debt will be canceled in a year, so I'm not going to lend him any money. Even though he's starving and needs a loan, I'm not going to give it to him because we know he's going to use the cancellation of debt at the end of the year, and I'll never get my money back. So he said, you better not do that. Open your hand, give him the money, whatever he needs, because loans in the ancient times were loans of sustenance, loans of helping someone eat. Right? So he said, what do you mean letting this guy starve? Give him something, lend him some money and let him get on his feet. Torah warns us not to take this attitude. But do you think people listen? Nah. Right? So something needed to be done to fix this. Also, now that we're in a more mercantile society, it's not an agricultural society, you're not borrowing money to plant the seeds, but rather, you're a little shop or something and people are using loans for different types of purposes. Something needed to be done to fix the problem of loans, to deal with a law in the Torah that wasn't working in the marketplace. So, Shirley, is it your turn? We're in Mishnah and Shavuot. The Mishnah talks about the sabbatical year, the seventh year. Go ahead.
A first rule was not canceled. This was one of the...
A loan secured. So if you can get this special document, which we'll see what it is in a minute, if you get this special document, then your loan's not canceled. Right? The seventh year comes, and guess what? He still owes you $1,000, even though the seventh year... Go ahead.
This was one of the things instituted by Hillel the Elder.
There you have it again. Elder, that's how he's known. Go ahead.
For when he observed people refraining from lending to one another, and thus transgressing what is written in the law, beware lest there be a base thought in thy heart.
Again, the Torah says, beware lest there be a stupid thought in your heart since the sabbatical year is coming, I will not lend him money. And he says this. So the Torah says you should give him money. But nobody's listening to the Torah. They're not lending.
He instituted
for what's the principle? Go ahead.
This is the formula of the first rule. I declare before you, so-and-so, judges of that place, that touching any debt that I may have outstanding, I shall collect it whenever I desire. And the judges sign below, or the witnesses.
Okay. So then the question is, if the Torah says that your debts are canceled after 7 years, how come if you have this piece of paper, suddenly your debts are not canceled? So there are two theories. One is that the debt cancellation is a real law, and it was in full force in the days of Hillel, in the Second Temple period, the laws were in full force, even though some of the laws in the Second Temple didn't pertain, like the Jubilee year. They didn't have a Jubilee year in the Second Temple, only in the First Temple. So even though some of the laws, some of these types of agricultural laws didn't pertain in the Second Temple, but this law pertained. It was a Torah law, and he managed to get around the Torah law. How did he get around it? He said, you know that loan that I have, that this guy owns me $1,000? He doesn't owe me. I'm giving my loan. I'm going to give it to the court. See that court? I present to them. I'm presenting my loan. So now it belongs to them. Now the court is not Jewish. They're an institution. They're a corporation. And they're going to collect the loan, not me. But I hereby hand over all my loans. I submit them before this court. And once you give your loans to the court can collect them. Practically speaking, I don't hand my document over. I just say I do. In the document, it says, I declare before you, declare is a bad translation. Some people say, Mosrani could mean I submit before you. No, like when I say I submit before you, you can submit before someone, or you can submit before someone. Is it words, or is it action? The implication is that it's just words. Good? It's just words. By saying it, it's as if you handed it over. So he's taking a loophole that perhaps existed before he was born, that you could give over your documents to the court, and he says, well, you could submit that you hand your documents to the court without actually handing the documents to the court.
And then in the sabbatical year,
yeah. No, whenever you want to collect a loan, you can collect it. You can go knock on the guy's door. The day after the sabbatical year, you can go knock on the guy's door. He'll say, hey, what about the sabbatical year? He says, sorry, I got this document. It says, Hillel says I can still collect.
So is that the mechanism we use on Passover when we sell our
food? That type of thing, yeah. But this is still done. We should do this. If people owe you money, then you should do this right before the sabbatical year comes to an end. I think it's coming up soon. I forget whether this year or the next year. You should actually write this whole document. It doesn't take much. You get a little quarter of three Jews and you officially do it. I try to do it every 7 years, even though not many people owe me money. But, yes?
So, Rabbi, has anybody disputed this by saying, okay, you have created an intermediary step, but in essence, you still have loan to your brother?
Mm-hmm.
So even though there's an intermediary step,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't change the fact that you've loaned your brother.
Oh, it's not only intermediary. It's a non-human entity. It's a court.
Right.
So the court's not bound by anything.
The court's not bound.
Right.
So you took this step, but in essence, the effect is the same. In other words, the table's the court.
Right.
I did it to the table does it to you.
Right.
But in...
I mean,
I
would take your question at two levels. One is, come on, in the end, this guy owes you money, and you're collecting against the Torah. And then take it to another level, which is that morally it's the same situation. The guy owes you money and you're not letting, and the guy's debt piled up over 7 years. He's got one of these American credit cards that's out of the roof. And you're not giving him a break so he can have a fresh start. And the Torah told us to give him a fresh start, and you don't give him a fresh start. So he was willing to do that because he thought overall it was good because credit stops. And as we know from the Fed, you know, you got to have someone controlling the credit, you know. And he felt like there were no loans. It was like the 2008, and you couldn't get a loan. He says, you can't get a loan, then you can't plant your seeds, you can't do anything, and everything is dead. So he felt it was.
I'm not arguing that there's actually more compassion and function in economy by doing that.
Yes. Oh, it's surprising. It's a.
This actually deleted the law and made a new law. I think is that what you mean? Or somebody still imposed the old law?
Yes. This. That's correct.
Everybody, right. You basically changed the law and used something to pretend like you really didn't change the law, but
right. So if you ask that question, then you really get it. That this is radical. This is very radical. He seemed to have gotten around the law. It's one thing you have an absolute some loopholes are real loopholes. It's true, you know. Chametz belong to a Gentile. What can you do? But some loopholes, you say, is that really a loophole? I mean, wait a second. The loan is still a loan. You didn't really give the loan does not really belong to the court. It really is your loan. This is phony. So one answer is that during the Second Temple period, these laws don't really apply. It's according to Torah law, the debts are not canceled. Without a jubilee year, all the sabbaticals are connected to each other. So the sabbatical year is rabbinic law. The jubilee year is canceled, and the idea of a sabbatical of loans is really doesn't apply anymore. The rabbi said it applies, and this rabbi came and said, you know what, it doesn't really apply. Or you know, you write this mumbo jumbo, and it doesn't apply. So that's one approach. It's not a Torah law, or maybe that this rule is not so radical because there is an idea that if you give your documents to the court, it works. But yes, people whose philosophy it is that Judaism needs to change, they often cite Hillel and they say, you see, he changed Judaism. That's what we need to do today is change Judaism. One can argue that there were certain halachic mechanisms in place. A, he may have maintained the position that this is just rabbinic law to begin with, so we have much more room to fiddle with it. And B, what was the other idea? He may have come up with a mechanism that really works according to Torah law. So it's true. He dealt with the modern problem, an ethical problem. He dealt with it well. So would you have expected this from this modest, gentle Hillel or not?
Not 2,000 years ago.
Sorry?
It seems manipulative
of the law.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you wouldn't expect it from the modest, right? He seems so humble, right? This is something someone powerful. This is someone powerful would do. But what's the other side of it?
Well, he loved all creatures, so he thought it'd bring him closer to the Torah by showing right. That the Torah was gentle, I guess.
Good. He's bringing people closer to the Torah, like Aaron. Like he said, you should be like Aaron. And who's who is he doing this for? For whom is he doing this? Particularly?
People who need
the poor.
Money.
The poor. So once again, the poor, right? He was poor. He's concerned with the poor. He considers himself, he acts like he's poor. Right. Sorry? Yeah. And so he is, it is consistent. But again, it's not a type of modesty we might picture of somebody, cartoon character, very humble guy. He is powerful. He did something very powerful.
A little bit like Abraham debating with God in Sodom and Gomorrah. Mm-hmm. You know, would you for a kindness. Would you really do that? So Hillel is questioning the law because there's a greater kindness here. We want this law to apply.
Right. And then, again, the Orthodox argument is, and then after deciding that he needed to take an action, he then found the halachic way. He found the halachic mechanism to do this within the system, right? But yes, it's a very controversial thing. Then we go to the mission Erechin, lesser known, and that is, you know, that fields you can always buy back your ancestral fields, and at the 50th Jubilee year, it comes back to you anyway. A house in a walled city, I guess it's considered prime proper real estate. You have a year to buy it back. If you lose your house in a walled city, you only get, the Torah says, you only have a year to buy it back. So what happened? Francine, would you read that for us? What happened?
Mishnah. Before he, the buyer, used to hide himself on the last day of the 12 months so that the house might become his permanent possession.
He's got like rent control. You know, he's sitting in this house. And the other guy told him, you know, I really don't want to sell this house. I'm going to buy it back during the year. So, oh, yeah, sure, yeah. So you can, I'll just give it to you for $20,000. He buys the house for $20,000. But then the rule is you can only buy it back for the next rest of the year. He goes to the Bahamas for a few months. And then the poor guy's trying to buy back the house. He can't find them to buy it back. So the year's over. Once the year's over, he can't automatically get it back because he's the previous owner. He doesn't have a right of repurchase. So the guy's out of luck. Go ahead.
But Hillel ordained that he that sold it could deposit his money in a chamber and break down the door and enter, and that the other, whenever he wanted, might come and take his money.
Right. You walk into, or you say, Goldberg, where are you? Goldberg. Where? Oh, he's not here. All right. You go to court. Say, here's the money for Goldberg. Okay. I'm taking possession. That's it. I'm coming in. So, when Goldberg comes back, he'll find his possessions on the front door. And his money for the rent, for the buying back, will be over there. So again, definitely interest in, it's could be for the poor, it could also be just economic, oiling the machine so that, things would happen. He's dealing with abuses of the law. Don't forget, perhaps you could accuse him of abusing the law, but he's also dealing with abuses of the law.
Here he was actually supporting the law. I mean, he was making the law more enforceable by doing this. It's not where he was doing away with the law.
Yes. The other one is very troubling because the Torah specifically says no one should withhold. They should loan. So the Torah tells you the solution is loan. But he came up with a different solution. So. Anyway, then there's another realm of his. I'm trying to tie together all the pieces of what we know about him. There isn't that much we know. One thing is he's Mr. Midrash. There are, in the morning, how many principles are there? Rabbi Shmuel Omer, Bishloshes, Rabbi Midot, HaTorah Midrash, there are 13 principles of hermeneutics of which the Torah is interpreted. For instance, let's say, minori ad major. In other words, kal vachomer, you say, look, if you can do this on Shabbos, you can certainly do it on Yontif. I mean, if you can even do it on Shabbos, of course you can do it on Yontif, right? So, right, if, give me another example, right? Or, the, comparison of equals, like, it says the word, purchase over here, and it says the word purchase over here. So just like this purchase is with money, so too this purchase is with money, or things like that. So there are all kinds of midrashic principles that from which you can learn so much more than what's written in the text and go way beyond. So seven of the laws, they're attributed to Hillel. Hillel the elder expounded on seven methods before the elders of Batera. This goes to the story in Pesachim that I told you I didn't tell you, which was that one time Pesach fell on Pesach, the day before Pesach, you're supposed to slaughter the lamb, fell the day before Shabbos. And they said, hey, what are we supposed to do? Are we supposed to slaughter the lamb on Shabbos or not? So he said, I'll prove it. He tried to prove it using some of these hermeneutic principles, these midrashic principles, the principles of midrash. And he convinced them that this is true. And he said he heard this from his teachers, Shmaya and Avtalion, and they said, great, this is wonderful. You're the new chief rabbi. You're the new Nasi. And that's how he became who he was. So the question of Midrash is very central to who he is. He got his position based on his expertise in Midrash. So again, we ask ourselves a question. What does this tell us about a man of, what does this have to do with the idea? What is his contribution to Midrash have to do with his personal character and his leanings? Now, is there any connection? He's Mr. Midrash. He's got these new tools. He's got a bag full of tools. Oh, you got a Torah, you got a verse in the Torah? I have all these tools to interpret it. Got this trick. I can learn new laws from here and there. What does that have to do with his great modesty, his love of the poor, his interest in the people, his interest in bringing people close to the Torah? Doesn't seem to have any connection. This is his scholarly activity. He learns Midrash. On the other hand, he's this nice guy who likes to help people. Doesn't seem to be connected, right?
Tools are helpful.
Oh, tools are helpful. What do you do with the tools?
It helps people understand the Torah better.
And if you have a problem, and if the poor people are suffering and whatever, then what happens?
They can solve the problems.
Right. Without the tools of Midrash, so it's like, you're like Bible thumping preachers who say, oh, it says in the Bible, right? The Word of God, right? What are you going to do? It's right there, right? But they don't have Rashi, and they don't have Ramban, they don't have the Gemara, and they don't have the other, right? And then Tosfos and the Rashi, right? So if you have tools, then you say, yes, the Word of God, but look, you got this word over here and the other word over there. Over here, this rule applies. So over there, the rule also applies. And you can see the context, something similar in another place. Oh, in another place, we find something similar. Over there, certain rules apply. Maybe those should apply here too. Right? You could derive something from its context. So if you have a lot of tools, you can help people. You're not stuck being this Bible-thumping guy. You can deal. Now, again, as a traditional Jew, I don't think he changed the whole Torah. I don't think one man wrote the whole oral tradition. I think the oral tradition, much of it, was there already. But clearly you could bring, of the thousands of things in Jewish law, many of them could go back to Moses or earlier periods. And some of the things he could come up with or begin to sow the seeds for his students to come up with, which eventually turns into the whole Talmud. And the seeds come from his hermeneutics. He's not the only one with hermeneutical principles, with midrashic principles. Later on in the days of Rabbi Akiva, he's big on it. His friend Rabbi Ishmael, who we quote every day, they had 13 principles. There's another one that has 32 principles. So I'm not saying he's the only one, but it does fit with who he is. He's got to help the people. You can't help the people if you're some kind of fundamentalist. If you're a fundamentalist, then the law wins. Tough luck on you, poor person. Right? Then I can't help you. The Bible says. Okay? So, this is also connected. And therefore, it's connected to something else too. And that's the next passage in Beitza. Talmud in Beitza says, there was a debate. There was a famous debate. Apparently, this went way back. Every generation, the Nasi, one rabbi said this, and the other rabbi said that. When you go to the temple, you're supposed to confess your sins on the sacrifice. That was really the moving part. People think about the slaughtering part. Slaughtering was, somebody else did the slaughtering. What the moving part of going to bring a sacrifice, you get to confess your sins on the head of the animal, and you know this animal's going to be slaughtered, so it's a very dramatic thing. You confess your sins, and then the animal's, is gone. So it's a scapegoat of sorts. So it was a very moving thing. So people love to put their hands on the animal. The women enjoyed it particularly also. So the question was, can the women do it? Should you do it on Yontif? Can you put your hands on the animal on Yontif? The rabbi said you shouldn't ride an animal on Yontif. You shouldn't ride a horse on Yontif. It's a rabbinic violation. We all know we don't ride horses on Yontif. But can you put your hands on the animal? Because when they did confession, they didn't just gently put their hands like this. They would put their whole weight. I think they actually jump up, put their hands down, jump up, put their entire weight on the cow's head or the sheep's head. Just for a second. So, could the women do it? Could they do it on Yontif? So, listen to this story. Whose turn is it? Let's see. Alvin?
Our rabbi taught it once happened that Hillel the elder brought his burnt offering into the temple court of a festival for the purpose.
So it's Yontif? And you're not supposed to ride an animal, but should you put your hands on it? Go ahead.
Of laying hands thereon.
He thought you should put your hands on it. Go ahead.
The disciples of Shammai and the elder gathered around him and asked, what is the nature of the animals? Now, he replied to them, it is a female, and I brought it as a peace offering, and such is not offered as a burnt offering.
I think, therefore, he's not going to do, he doesn't have to, as a peace offering, he doesn't do any confession on it. So he says, leave me alone, I'm not doing any confession. I'm just, it's a female, and I'm doing it for, it's not a burnt offering, which would be male, it's a female. Now, of course, you could easily check out the question, but we'll talk about that in a second. Go ahead.
He wanted to avoid a quarrel and told them what was not true for the sake of peace.
He lied. Okay, go on.
Thereupon, he swung its tail for them in order to make them believe it was a female.
He did something or other with that part of the animal and kind of gave some impression. Okay, whatever it was. Go ahead.
And they went away.
Okay, so how does this fit? How does this fit? I guess their eyesight wasn't very good. How does this fit with the image of Hillel, who tries to use whatever tools he has to help the poor, and he's so modest? And what is this fib over here? How does that fit with everything?
He said he didn't want to get in an argument.
Right. So firstly, he doesn't want to get in an argument.
They had a disagreement as to the law. No, he believed you could do this.
On the animal.
Festival, mm-hmm. And they said you couldn't.
Right.
He said, "Well, I'm not going to be doing that. I'm doing something else."
Right. So that's the modesty. So we see him sort of kowtowing to Shammai. In the days of in his own life, he's kowtowing to Shammai and his students, which raises a question. Maybe that's what when we have memories of Hillel the modest. Maybe that's the memory. Right. Don't forget these are memories that are way after the person was dead. Okay. So these stories could reflect basic truths, but the stories could be embellished over the years. But the basic truth, what is the kernel of the memory? The kernel of the memory about Hillel was he maneuvered himself. He kind of made himself small and modest and allowed the other rabbi to have his day. There's another story. I forgot to put it on here that there was one day. It was one of the worst days for the Jewish people, and that day there were more people from Shammai, and Hillel had to sit there and he had to do whatever Shammai said. And there's another story that maybe people were killed in this process. They may have been brought to blows at some point. So this could be part of the memory that when he needed to, he kind of humbled himself. And since he humbled himself, right? Therefore, in the end, people remembered, oh, the wonderful Hillel, he was so humble and he was so nice. So in the end, he won. But in his day, he was very humble. Yes?
Rabbi, I had this picture of Hillel now, kind of interesting. Two strong attributes. One, it's sort of a very practical, almost you might say, a real politic side to him to accomplish the things that he needed to accomplish. Mm-hmm. That you might say is not so good or manipulative, or maybe it is. The other attribute is that things that he wanted to accomplish were so great, kindness, peace, helping the poor, that those two sort of came together in a great way that almost never does in history.
Usually, we're going to see Ram Gamliel, he has to... All of Judaism is falling apart. The temple's destroyed. He's going to have to really reign. He may have to be a tyrant to get things done. Here's a man who, for maybe at the particular moment in history, he came. Things he needed to do didn't conflict with being modest. Right.
For the right reasons.
Right.
Do it for himself.
Right. Sometimes what you need to do conflicts with being modest. Rabbi Schechter talks about that. He says, if you're a rabbi, if you're a cantor, if you're giving a speech, if you get an aliyah, these things compromise your modesty. But there's not much choice. Somebody has to do these things, right? Someone has to teach, and so these things, are, being the chief rabbi or the nasi is not a modest position, right? But somehow he was able to combine the two. It's good.
You know, other things that are dignified matter. You still save yourself and your image.
Right. If you do it in a humble manner, perhaps in a humble manner. But the law, it's hard to picture that he pushed that law through. We know Obama, a lot of laws he can't get through. The Congress tries to get things, but they can't. To push a law through, you know, look, he couldn't even do it. He wasn't even free in his own temple, you know. He must have, he had to be pretty strong to get these laws through. They were accepted. So, but yes, somehow he did it in a nice way. And, like Moses, somehow it worked. So I have a number of theories as to. We have a couple more minutes. Are we good? A couple more. Okay, almost. We'll try to be brief. So what's the significance of all these modesty stories? Why do we have so many modesty stories? So it could be a metaphor for getting along with Herod. I mean, here's this guy thriving as one of the great rabbis of all time. We don't have any stories about his blood spilling or anything. And here's this crazy man who's killing his own wife and his children. He's nuts. And he's a megalomaniac. Look at that hotel he built. It's ridiculous, right? You didn't need to make it so big. He's crazy. This is a crazy person. And here's Hillel living at that same time. And he's like the opposite. He's Mr. Modest. And he's getting everything done. And Judaism is growing. I mean, Judaism is falling apart. The temple's about to be destroyed. But Judaism is also, in some ways, he's building the infrastructure for the Talmudic Judaism, which is going to break out and explode afterwards, and he sets the ground for it. So is it a something about getting along with Herod? In that vein, you look at this passage from Josephus. There's this fellow named Pollio. There are other ways of putting it. This is one my edition says Pollio, the Pharisee. We're all Pharisees. That's where the sect we're from, and Sammius. So it sounds, the first guy doesn't sound like Hillel, but Sammius sounds a little bit like Shammai. Or it's Shmaya and Avtalion, that Pollio is Avtalion, his Rebbe. It's not Hillel, it's Hillel's Rebbe. Anyway, so Josephus refers to somebody who kind of got along with Herod. So maybe it refers, maybe the memory was that he was so modest he was able to stay out of the hair of this maniac called Herod, who was the leader of Israel at that time. Or maybe it's about the modesty as a memory of how he stayed out of trouble with Shammai, that he was able to, he laid low, sometimes he had to kowtow to him. Okay. Like we saw before, he had to pretend he was following the Shammai law. Or maybe it's a image for the idea that he opened learning to everybody. Learning was this iconoclastic thing. Maybe it was like the Catholic Church, you know. If you're a scholar, then you're plain people. I mean, what do they know? They shouldn't even read this thing, you know. Right? And maybe he opens the houses of learning that creates this explosion of learning. He's putting lots of eggs under the chicken, right? And the thing explodes, that lots of chicks, come out of the deal. So, maybe that's the image of modesty, that he was more open to, the common man coming and learning. And maybe this is a little more radical to Gentiles too. That part of the growth of Judaism was, all those Romans and anybody else who was Greeks, anybody, the Arameans or Arabs, whoever was around in those days, he brought a few of those guys in too. Of course, you know, one of the famous ones later on was Rabbi Akiva. His father was a convert. He opened that door as well. It's easy enough to dismiss the convert. He somehow opened them up. So these are different theories as to what his modesty is really all about, the significance of his modesty. It's very nice. We can all learn from his modesty. Of course, I can just leave it like that. There was once a rabbi, he was very modest, and we could all learn from him, we should be modest. But it also could be connected with his legacy in terms of Herod, Shammai, opening the learning, or the idea of opening Judaism more to the Gentiles as well. finally, of course, he's very much known for, you know, whatever you hate, don't do to your friend. Da'alachsane, what is hateful to you, don't do to your friend. He's known for this. It's an interesting question. Did he make this up? Actually, the Book of Tobith, which is a Jewish apocryphal book, it's a book that we don't like, but it is a Jewish book. It is 200 years before him, said something very similar. So he didn't necessarily make this up, but again, a very appropriate saying for someone who's so concerned about people. Also, if he was Greek, there were Greeks who said similar things. Anybody, any scholar, any Confucius, everybody said, whatever you hate, don't do to your friend. People just put it in different words. But here are some theories about different people he may have been copying from. But we don't need to believe that he made up that statement. Now, why is the house of Hillel known to be lenient based on what we said? Could say that what? Known to be lenient because he was interested in the people, interested in the poor, etc. Now, some would say, some like to, I give Rabbi Grossman credit for calling his son one Shammai and one Hillel, because Shammai is not a bad guy. And this Rabbi Lau, he tries to say, well, you know, the lesson for today is that we shouldn't be like these crazy zealots like Shammai, we should be like Hillel. I would respectfully disagree. Great man, he's doing great things in Jerusalem. But I would respectfully disagree. I would say that that between the two, between a Shammai and a Hillel, that's where greatness comes. You know, we don't need to expunge the community of people who are extreme. If people are too extreme, we need, you know, have to deal with it. But having some people who are tend towards zealotry, and other people who tend to kindness and leniency and interest in the poor, together you have a community. It's sort of a yin and a yang, and it brings a balance to things. So Shammai, I think, played their role too in bringing the balance. So if we ask ourselves, you know, what makes Hillel so great and so central, it's interesting that they don't focus on his scholarship. There's just this little story that, you know, he was so devoted that he was snowed in as he was learning. We get the idea, you know, he was very learned. What he learned and how he learned, we can just imagine from the schools of Shammai and the schools of Hillel, he obviously taught thousands of things, and we just don't have memories of exactly what he taught and what he said. But obviously, his scholarship was huge. But I want to argue that many of the great figures of our history, Rashi, Rambam, Rav Yosef Karel, Chafetz Chaim, Rabbi Soloveitchik, and that's just a beginning of a list, but you could expand the list exponentially. They were all known for two things: their scholarship and their fill in the blank, their interest in philosophy, mysticism, kindness, piety, pietism. It's the combination of personal attributes and scholarship. That's what makes great leaders. Rashi, he's always kind of didactically telling us, you know, certain thing, lessons that we should learn. The Ramban, a mystic, a doctor, a great Talmudist, a commentator in the Torah, a commentator in the Talmud, a legalist, a philosopher, a preacher. Rambam, the greatest philosopher, the greatest legal scholar. Combination. Joseph Caro, he was so mystical. He used to have a voice that spoke through his body. He had this image that there was like an angel or something who was speaking to him every day. He was this huge mystic. But during the day, he put that aside and he wrote the greatest code of Jewish law that ever was. And that was the Chafetz Chaim. He's the source of not just Lashon Hara, but the basic, what's the law? Look in the Mishnah Berurah. He tells you, the Chafetz Chaim, he tells you the law is all based on the Mishnah Berurah. Why the Mishnah Berurah? There are other scholars much greater than he was. The answer is, because he was such a pious man, who could not listen to him? So he tried not to speak Lashon Hara. He preached it. He lived. He devoted himself to that. So pious. So his scholarship was more recognized. Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, philosopher, Talmudist. It's the combination that makes him so great. In the case of Hillel, strangely enough, history records more about his personality than about his laws. But the implication that he hit on both cylinders. He was great in both realms. So that's our theory for this week. Next week we'll be talking about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the great revolutionary. Then we'll be talking about Rabbi Gamliel, the tyrant, and et cetera, et cetera. So we hope you'll join us, and we have 4 weeks in total, and we'll be going straight. There's some confusion on the flyer. It's at 7:30, and each week. And then we're not taking any weeks off. We're going straight through October 31st, et cetera, going right through. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.